polarizing is going in the wrong direction. All Washington does is divide us and talk about who's to blame.
Of the Republicans in the race, Hovde presents the most formidable challenge to incumbent Democrat Tammy Baldwin. I'm Nate Wuggehout, Civic Media News.
Is it Saturday night yet? Hey folks, Jimmy K here. Join me, Rocker, and Terry Barr for Max Inc. Saturday Night. It's your weekly look at the Wisconsin music scene with a lot of fun, debut music, interviews with the artist, and live in the lair. It's Max Inc. on Saturday night across the Civic Media Radio Network, Saturday night, 6 to 10 p.m., and grab the podcast at maxincradio.com. It's Max Inc. on Civic Media. We are local music.
You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay, WGBW, home of Mino and the Mayor.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here. Today on the big program, lots to get to. Lots to talk about. I was thinking about 13 years ago today where I was sleeping on the Capitol floor in Wisconsin as Scott Walker was ramming through and the Republicans were ramming through Act 10 to destroy public sector workers and to turn the corner on Wisconsin's progress, to undo the forward progress of Wisconsin by bringing in anti-worker legislation by, you know, look, the corporatists took over. And I was thinking about this today because it was one of those moments where I remember having conversations with people back then about, you know, fighting for what America is. Fighting for the future of the working class, ensuring that our kids have opportunities. And this idea of making America the best it can be. And, you know, I was thinking about this today because I just had a conversation with someone who told me that they were fighting. They were fighting for the heart and soul of what America is. And this person told me that he would fight to the death for, and this is a quote, "We will fight to the death for our America." Not the inclusive America, not the our, he, me, and him. Our meaning his little sect, his small world view, his little red hat brigade. And it got me to thinking, and it got me asking questions of, you know, when do you think America was great? That you want to make it great again? What was that period? And I've asked this to every one of my red hat friends over the years. This is not new. You've heard this before. And most of them come back to this, you know, the 1950s and 60s, we had strong manufacturing. We had a prosperous working class. You know, one income could support a family. Those people knew their place. And, you know, it got me, you know, thinking that, look, you know, we are in a fight for the heart and soul of America. We are in a fight for life, liberty, the pursuit of happiness for everyone, because that's under assault. I may not agree with what you do, but you've got the right to do what you want until, well, I think it was Justice Black who said, you've got the right to flail your fists until it touches the tip of my nose. And that's how I've always led my life. And I think everyone should. My grandfather would always say, don't worry about me, worry about yourself. Take care of your four walls. Make your little corner of the world the best it can be. And don't impose that on others. And yet here we are in a moment where I have the Red Hat Brigade telling me that they're in a fight for the soul of what America is. And that they'll fight to the death for their America, their version of what it was. And I got to tell you, that's quite frightening to me. Because, well, one, they're well-armed, and they like to remind me how well-armed they are, and how desperate. And you put those things together, and that's a frightening combination. That's a deadly cocktail. And I went through recently and had, you know, these conversations with some of my Red Hat Brigade, who, you know, tell me what the Make America Great vision is. Now, understand, these are people. And this is the bizarre part of me. These are working class people. These are working class folks who have struggled. These are working class people who are rightfully angry, looking to a billionaire as their champion. Someone who's never gotten his hands dirty. In fact, he's a germaphobe. Someone who's never done a hard day's labor. Never had to worry if he's going to be able to make ends meet. Never going to worry about, am I going to be able to put shoes on my kids' feet before they go to school? None of the working class problems that we face every day. No, no. The billionaire knows what working class people need. Evidently. And this is the weird part in all of this. Someone who's never had to deal with the kind of problems that families deal with in this country. And look, I understand the anger. It's real, and it's, in a lot of cases, righteous. It's right. The fact that our political system does nothing to address the needs of working families. And yet, we're sold this drumbeat of right-wing kookery. We're sold this right-wing drumbeat of hyper-individualism. We don't need government to solve problems that we individually can't. Let the corporations do that. You know, you think about what MAGA says they believe in. It's like conservatives used to say, well, they believed in limited government, yet every time they get in control, they expand government into our bedrooms. Lower taxes. For billionaires. Not for the average everyday working person. No, that's a fallacy. And a strong national defense. And you look at the fact that all of those things, I must have missed the day they did any of those. So when the MAGA crowd tells me we want strong border security and allows the Republicans to get away with doing nothing, you kind of go, I doubt that. When you talk about America first, what does that mean? Does that mean, you know, trade deals? Does that mean manufacturing? Does that mean, reshoring manufacturing, investing in the country, in education and healthcare and all those things that would help us be more competitive, that would help us thrive? Does it mean that? Well, no. They believe in law and order, they say. We're going to crack down on those criminals until it's them that are the criminals. And then, oh my gosh, the justice system's broken. They talk about national pride. We need to have national pride. Except, well, for others. And I love the whole religious freedom nonsense. I get this all the time. I want religious freedom, except for you. You know, we're too politically correct, Rick. Really? What you're really saying is you want to have the right to be a total and complete a-hole. That I understand. And you go down through all of this and you go, look, what they really want is they want to destroy what did make this country great. The fact that we had strong labor laws. The fact that we had strong child labor protections. The fact that we did things to help people. We raised the minimum wage. We did all kinds of things to protect workers, to help the least among us. You know, to follow that guy they like to talk about in the book they love so much. But yet, we're in this game of red hat, blue hat, red state, blue state. And you know what these are. You know, any state pursuing the no rights at work agenda, a tax on collective bargaining, a tax on unemployment, a tax on workers' compensation. Those are going to be red states. States that expand the right to vote, states that expand Medicaid to ensure that poor people get insurance. You know, those are probably going to be blue states. This is a weird world we live in. Because the red states who tell us that they're the freedom-loving folks who don't want to pay taxes, they don't. Because the red states are the welfare states who are sucking up all of the revenue from the blue states. And yet, somehow, they love to play the victim. It's really remarkable to me. And one of the states front and center in this red hat, blue hat world is Iowa. And when we come back, Iowa State Representative Sammy Sheets is going to be here to share some thoughts on just how bad it's gotten.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So I gotta tell you, one state that has gone full on dyed-in-the-wool red hat, our friends out in Iowa. Wow! They've attacked education, attacking workers' rights, gutted child labor protections, and, you know, you stake the flag in the ground on the pro-life side so deep you can't even see it anymore. Especially now that you look at Republican leadership refused to allow a vote to have a school lunch program that allowed poor and working class kids to get a free lunch. This is just mind blowing. Again, these are the people who tell you how much they love the children. Love me some children. But when we need to actually take care of them, feed them, clothe them, educate, healthcare, all that stuff. Well, we're not that pro-life. Anyway, here to share some thoughts on just how far down our friends out in the Iowa state have gone. I've asked my good friend Sammy Sheets to come talk with us. Sammy's a state representative out there and one of the good guys. He's the guy who put forth this legislation to live up to those pro-life values and actually feed the children. Sammy, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks for having me, Rick. Appreciate it.
So walk me through this. I'm looking at this story and it looks like a majority of both sides of the aisle, Republicans, Democrats, a bipartisan, nonpartisan support to feed children. How does this not get passed?
Party politics, plain and simple. So I proposed a bill last session that would have fed 23,000 kids for about $1 million a year, which, you know, sounds big to listeners, but for our state budget, which is around $8 billion a year, it's less than 0.1% of our state budget that could have fed 23,000 kids who qualify for reduced lunch. Now, I personally support universal, complete free school lunch for everybody in our state. But given the fact that we have a Republican trifecta in Iowa, I thought, hey, this is a good compromise bill. This is something that people will agree with. The appropriation, the cost is really low compared to our overall state budget. This is just a no-brainer. To feed kids, especially after all the federal money during the pandemic ended, where everybody had universal free school lunch, I thought it was a no-brainer. I went and talked to literally almost every single Republican in the Iowa House, and surprisingly, I had 20 of them sign on to my bill, which I don't think has happened in years, maybe decades, that a Democrat's bill in the minority has been signed on to by almost a third of the Republican caucus. And if you do simple math, with 36 Democrats, 20 Republicans, it's 56 votes, which is a majority in the Iowa House. Unfortunately, it didn't even get a subcommittee. The Republicans didn't even allow the bill to get what is like the most basic level of our legislative process, which is a subcommittee. They didn't even let us have a discussion on the issue. And this makes sense because our governor, over the summer, like some of the other really right-wing governors across the country, decided to deny using federal funds from the federal government, the Biden administration, to feed kids over the summer. This would have been $29 million of federal money. That's our taxpayer money in Iowa, by the way, that we pay regardless whether she decides to use the funds or not, would have fed hundreds of thousands of kids during the summer. And she said no. She said obesity was the reason that she didn't want to support the legislation. Yeah, I mean, the most tone-deaf politics. Correct. It's so, hard to believe.
So we're gonna slim the kids down by starving them over the summer. That's even better than Reagan's justification for doing away with the program from the 70s that did that had school lunches for kids, you know, over the summertime. When Reagan became president, he did away with that. You know, Mr. Ketchup is a vegetable.
Yep. So, I mean, it is no secret that the Republicans in my state are comfortable with letting kids starve, and that's one of the saddest and worst realities that exist. But I think my school lunch bill is just proof of that, where there are literally, it's on paper, there's enough votes to pass it out of the House, and it doesn't even get a subcommittee because the Republican leadership doesn't want to discuss it.
Well, it's not their kids. Understand, you know, when we're talking about the kids that would benefit from these programs, it's not our kids. It's those kids. It's those poor kids. And you see this across the board, be it with school lunch programs, be it with the school programs in general, the school funding bills, the voucher schemes, the charter nonsense, all of these silver bullet solutions to fix education are all done on the backs of poor and working class kids. It's never their kids. No, never.
No, and the really screwed up part, Rick, is that last session alone, not that long ago, the Republicans passed a bill which cost literally billions of dollars to grow the size of government because they wanted to hire 200 new investigators to find the rampant fraud that exists in our SNAP program. That's obviously food and health care that goes to kids, veterans, the elderly and disabled, the most marginalized people in our state. And the Republicans were willing to spend millions of our taxpayer dollars to try and investigate, again, air quotes, this rampant fraud. They were comfortable with spending that money and growing the size of government. Yeah. But God forbid we want to use $29 million in federal money, even though we'd have to put up a million or two to run the program. 29 million versus 2 million, that should be math that even Republicans can solve, right? Republican politicians can solve here at the state capitol.
Yeah, but if you remember, you know, Sammy, and the reality is Republicans, they don't have a problem wasting money as long as it's beaten up on poor people, especially poor people who need help. You may remember a couple years ago, they had this fetish about drug testing every welfare recipient. And yet, when they spent millions of dollars trying to hunt down, you know, the single mother who's trying to keep a roof over their kid's head, They came up with nothing. A lot of these programs then went by the wayside. But, hey, you know, we got to kick around some poor people for a bit. That made them all happy and tingly in the panties.
Correct. And you have to remember over and over again where the priorities are for the Republican Party. We had no problem spending literally hundreds of millions of dollars in corporate tax breaks. But when it comes to, you know, $1 million for the school lunch bill, $2 million to get that federal money to feed hundreds of thousands of kids, that's where we need to draw the line, Rick. That's where we need to draw the line.
Now, so where I started
to children.
Where I started today, we started with the game Red Hat, Blue Hat, you know, Red State, Blue State. And, you know, the school lunch program stuff, you know, are we restricting it or are we expanding it? A Red Hat, Blue Hat issue. The voucher stuff, most certainly a Red Hat, Red State issue. Attacking workers' rights. Very, very red state. You know, I'm going down this list of stuff, and Iowa is like at the top of it's almost like Iowa is the new Wisconsin. It's almost like all the bad ideas are percolating in your state because you've got the legislative trifecta where they can just roll through their agenda of harming students and child workers and, you know, workers in general. And now Iowa, a no rights at work state to begin with, they're trying to go even further, aren't they?
Yeah, and what happened in Wisconsin after passing some of the most right-wing legislation a decade ago for years and years and years? They now have, I think, Democrats have won 14 of the last 16 statewide elections. They have a Democratic governor, a Democratic senator, and I think just today they got fair maps for the first time in over a decade. And so I would, you know, be shocked if the Democrats didn't have massive improvements in their next legislative cycle, because people do not support these right-wing policies that attack working class, middle class families. They don't support it. And the Republicans can only get so much of this venomous legislation passed before people are going to stand up and say, this is what we want. This is not what we want out of our state government. We want our state government to stand up for basic protections for working people. We want our state government to fully fund our public education system. We want our state government to build our roads and bridges and actually invest in infrastructure. We want our state government to invest in mental health care when we're seeing a mental health care crisis across our country. And Iowa ranks 49th out of 50th in per capita mental health care spending. The Republicans will talk over and over and over again, in Iowa specifically, about this massive budget surplus that we have, $2 billion, $3 billion, that's basically in our rainy day fund. And every dollar that's in there is not being spent to fulfill our basic obligations as a state government that we owe the people of our state. And they want to keep touting that. And actually, I don't know if we're going to get to it, but we should talk about the proposal that our governor and our key tax committee members in the Republican Party proposed last week, which was to abolish the income tax in the state of Iowa. It would make us the first state. There are states that have never had the income tax that still don't, like Florida or Texas, but there's never been a state in the country that has had the income tax that has abolished the income tax, because it would be so detrimental to everything that we hold dear as a state: our public schools, our infrastructure, mental health care, childhood, affordable housing, all the things that we care about as Iowans.
You know, I listen to that, and you know, you see all of these tax cut bills. You see, you know, Missouri doing away with the corporate tax and some of the stuff that that they're working on, and you go, well, what kind of hellscape do you think you're going to create when you have no money to educate a populace, when you have no money to, you know, to pay law enforcement or to pave the roads or do any of the things that government does? And I know there's this worldview, especially on the conservative side, that the private sector, corporate America, is going to step in. And maybe that's the future they want, to where every time they step out their door, they're digging in their pocket, paying a toll, or digging in their pocket to, you know, cross a bridge. Every time they walk out the door, put a toll in, or, you know, every time they turn on their car, you know, paying per mile. I don't know what the future of these folks are looking for when they're gutting the very revenue that we need to maintain just the bare minimum of what we've got.
Well, let me jump in and tell you, they want a government that serves special interests and the wealthiest corporations and people in our state. Every policy that they've enacted has proven that, whether it's vouchers we just talked about a second ago. Starting in a year, will be basically not need-based at all, meaning a millionaire with four kids can have send their every single one of their kids to private school on the backs of working class families. That's what the Republican Party has passed. It talks about the corporate tax breaks. We went from having a progressive income tax to having a flat rate of 3.9%, which is now meaning that millionaires are going to be paying the same tax rate as nurses, as union workers, people across our state, which is fundamentally wrong. The rich be paying their fair share, as they did forever in Iowa. So fundamentally what they want out of our state government is a government that serves the wealthy corporations and some of the most privileged people in our society.
Now, you put out a TikTok video a couple of days back, you know, asking people to help defeat the anti-union legislation that's banging around in your state. Tell us what that is and how we can help.
Yeah. So basically, Iowa for the longest time, Rick, had what was known as the gold standard of public sector bargaining. It is called Chapter 20. And essentially, back in the 70s and the 80s, there was a massive teacher strike in Southeast Iowa in Keokuk, Lee County. And so a Republican governor and a Democratic legislature came up with a solution that was Chapter 20 that had some of the strongest worker rights and labor protection for public sector employees. A part of that compromise for so many great things that were included in the contracts, public sector workers gave up their right to strike. And so after that agreement was made, it was illegal for public sector workers to strike in the state of Iowa. Fast forward 40 years to 2017, the Republicans, just like I think it was Act 10 in Wisconsin, our Chapter 20 was gutted by the Republican Party. They, of course, still left the provision in Chapter 20 that made it illegal for public sector workers to strike, but they gutted all the topics that had been included in union contracts before that were mandatory to discuss and bargain on. And so basically gutted contracts for public sector workers across the state. So fast forward, I'm a staff rep for Teamsters Local 238 out of Cedar Rapids. Teamsters, some other unions like the Teachers Union, found ways around it and have been successful. And actually another piece of it was that it was forcing union workers to vote every year to keep their union. And what we saw, the Republicans thought that everybody would want to decertify and not have their union because of the evil union bosses, just taking your money, et cetera. The Teamsters this year and the ISCA or the NEA chapter in Iowa had 100% recertification rate because people want their unions, people want collective bargaining rights. And so what did the Republicans do this legislative session? One of the most notoriously anti-worker senators, a Republican named Adrian Dickey from Southern Iowa, proposed a bill that passed out of the Labor Committee in the Senate that's going to be actually debated on Wednesday this week by the full Iowa Senate that would allow employers, if employers don't submit lists of workers in a bargaining unit, the bargaining unit is automatically decertified. And a union has to go to court and district court to sue to get the employer to provide the list so that they can vote to recertify. So essentially, if this law passes, public sector workers, public sector bargaining units in the state will cease to exist.
And you're basically gutting the National Labor Relations Act, which is what's going on, not just in Iowa, but all across the country, as the moneyed interests are trying to get the National Labor Relations Act. After, 80-some-odd years, they're trying to push it through to try and make it unconstitutional after being an in-place, decided law for over 80 years. That's the new direction, and your state's front and center in all of this.
Yeah, and I mean the really good thing, and you asked me in the last question, what can we do to help? And the Teamsters are going to be having kind of caravan rally around the state capitol when this is debated on Wednesday. But the positive note, and why this is just so tone deaf, besides it being fundamentally wrong, is that in Iowa specifically, and I know across America, but in Iowa, we've seen a massive resurgence of the labor movement, of working class consciousness, of people deciding that we have power as a working class together, and we're going to stand up and fight for our rights. The Teamsters alone this last summer won a strike here in Des Moines. The year before that, they won a strike in Cedar Rapids. The UAW with John Deere had massive strikes that they won huge pay raises, et cetera, benefits. The year before that, we're seeing massive labor resurgence across Iowa. So for the Republican Party to choose now of all times to attack workers and working people, they're going to see what happens, right?
No, they have to. Look, they have to attack workers in this moment. They have to make it even harder to organize. They have to make it even harder to demand your rights because they know people want it, and it's surging. So what they have to do is they have to put more roadblocks in the way, and you know this as well as anyone.
Exactly. And what we know is that workers are going to stand up and fight back. In 2017, there were rallies with thousands of people, just like there was back then in Wisconsin. There was rallies with thousands of people every single day. Workers aren't just going to take this and lie down. We're going to fight back, and we're going to continue to tell Republican legislators that union busting is not okay.
There you go. Sammy, I appreciate you taking some time for us. Keep up the fight, doing the good work, fighting the righteous fight there, brother.
Thank you so much, Rick. I appreciate you having me on the show.
Thanks so much, State Representative Sammy Sheets. I want to hear your thoughts. Are you seeing this kind of assault on workers' rights, on education, on kids' school lunch programs, on child labor in your state? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. I want to hear it. For our Free Speech TV audience, thanks so much for tuning in. We'll see you back here next time. For our radio affiliates across the country, we're going to take a quick break. Back after this.
The Talk of Green Bay, WGBW.
I'm meteorologist Rodney Price. We'll see partly to mostly cloudy skies here in the overnight as our lows drop to the lower 30s. We'll have light winds. Sunshine expected to return Thursday, though, with afternoon highs generally in the mid-50s. Winds will turn to the west. A few clouds around the area Thursday night. It's 33 at our studios.
Earl Ingram.
My special guest is the curator and founder of Wisconsin's Black Historical Society, none other than Claiborne Benson.
I want people to know that Wisconsin has a beautiful, rich African-American history. Many people think the King celebration and all of those other kinds of things are more important. They occurred in Wisconsin as well, and we've impacted the entire nation.
The Earl Ingram Show, weekday mornings 8 to 10 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, I want to play a little game. A little red hat, blue hat. Red state, blue state. And not hard. It's not hard. It's really not. When you look at the policies that are being pushed by a lot of these red states and also blue states. Look, I would love to say that there's equal number of blue states out there that are pushing the agenda that I would like to see. There's just not. We are a divided country along the lines of being almost gerrymandered because of, look, you know, we've been sliced and diced. We've been pitted against each other. As Republicans got their way and broke up labor unions and broke up what community brought people together in the workplace and gave them a common interest, better wages, hours, conditions, they then went in a different direction. You know, hooray for me. The one who wins the most toys when he dies wins. And, you know, I started looking at this, what's happening right in front of us. And it really breaks down into, look at the states that are so-called right-to-work states. And for those who don't know what right-to-work laws are, they're the government. Now remember, these are the smaller government, less intrusive government, get government out of my life people who are pushing this. Right-to-work laws are simply the government saying that the employer and the employees cannot enter into a security agreement. That the employer and the employees, the bargaining unit for the employees, cannot say that the people who are employed there have to be members of a union and of the bargaining unit and have to pay for the services of the bargaining unit. They can't agree to that. Sorry, that's off the table. You're not allowed to talk about that. And that, again, these are the people who tell us they believe in smaller, less intrusive government, except, you know, in this area, because we need unions to protect people. And the argument is, I should be able to do whatever I want, wherever I want. And you can leave. As I've always said, if you don't like the job and the conditions that are at that job, you have the freedom to leave. And that's their mantra in every other condition except employment. And that's the part that just blows my mind. You don't like what's going on in the country. You don't like it. You don't love it. You can leave it. And when you go, no, I'm going to stay and change it. They, no, you're going to either. You love it the way it is. You're going to leave it. But in the workplace, no, you're going to like it. And it's quite sad because they've trained people to believe on some level that the right to work actually has some work or some rights. And I think Dr. King said it best. And it's a false slogan that brings no rights and no work. You're not guaranteed work. You don't have a right to a job in this country. If you did, I might be in favor of a right to work. But this isn't what that is. What this is starving unions of the resources to be able to aggressively bargain for their members. This is starving unions of the dues and the resources to be able to expand the power of working people to fight for better wages, hours, and conditions. And again, this is what the wealth class and corporate America want. They want pliable, desperate, separated workers. They want people pitted against each other so that they can easily manipulate whatever they want. And look at where we are as a country. You know, when the red hats talk about, we're going to make America great again. You know, again, they point to the 50s and 60s when you had 35% union density. When you had, you know, you couldn't cross a street without tripping over somebody who was carrying a union card. And those people with the union cards, they had better wages, hours, conditions. But during that period, an equal number of jobs paid similar, because, well, those employers, you know, were trying to bribe their employees not to unionize. So you had a broad share of the economy in that middle, where one income could support a family, where one parent could go off to work and the other one stayed at home and raised the children, and we had Leave It to Beaver. And we had policies in place that encouraged that kind of structure. And then, well, no, we're going to give corporate America the power to break that up. And that's what the Powell memo was really about. It was going to save capitalism by destroying workers' rights. Going to save capitalism by destroying education. Going to save capitalism by destroying governments. And they've been very successful. Make no doubt about it. They've trained a generation to believe that they're the ultimate arbiter of whatever happens in their lives, and that there's nothing beyond them, which is ludicrous. I mean, you make some decisions in your life, but a lot of stuff is well out of your control. You go to work. Who protects you at work? OSHA. You know, I go back to, we did a tour of a coal mine up in the Scranton, Pennsylvania area. And the person giving the tour, and this was just brilliant. I couldn't have asked for this to happen. I couldn't have written it up. You know, I couldn't have dreamt this moment up. But the guy who was giving the tour, he was doing a fabulous job. He was talking about how horrible the working conditions were, and he was setting the scene. The lights were dim. He's saying, you know, you got mules running by you, taking a dump on your foot. You're knee deep in, just a soup of slurry and a soup of animal feces and human feces. Because where else are you going to go? You don't see a restroom around here, do you? I mean, he did a great job of talking about, you know, how you're constantly cutting yourself on the sharp, you know, the sharpness of the coal, and your knees and your hands were always cut up, your face. And here you are in this muck, in this horrible, cold, nasty place. And you're, you know, 8, 9, 10 years old. And there's a woman from right behind me who goes, well, where was OSHA? And you go, well, this was 100 years. This was, you know, 50 years before OSHA. This was the reason OSHA was created. This was why we have the protections we have, and we fought for, generations fought for, and why Republicans want to destroy it. And, you know, you go down this red hat, blue hat game. You know, the states that want to weaken workers' ability to fight for better wages and hours and conditions, those are going to be your red states. States that want to strengthen minimum wage laws, generally going to be blue states. People who want to limit workers' compensation and make it harder for workers to protect themselves, generally going to be red states. States that push preemption laws on minimum wage or paid family leave or any of, you know, paid leave at all, those are going to be your red states. The people who didn't expand Medicaid, because why would we want to ensure that citizens get health care? And this is the part that blows my mind. My MAGA friends are like, we need to repeal Obamacare. You know, but that Affordable Care Act ain't so bad. But, you know, the part of it that blows my mind is you got the Trumps who are going, we've got to repeal Obamacare and we're going to replace it. And you go, well, what are you going to replace it with? Well, something better. Okay, what? And that's the weird thing. These are people who don't have the policy ideas. They want what working people want. And this is why I've made an attempt over the years to try and reach my red hat friends. Because the reality is they want the same things that everyone else wants, for the most part. They want good jobs. They want health care. They want some retirement security. They want good schools for their kids, safe neighborhoods. They want the same stuff. Maybe with different complexions in different areas, and we can argue about that if we have to, or gender identity. And I don't want to stay out of that, because the reality is, do your thing. Live your best life. But we're in this space where if we were actually talking to each other about the things that matter to us instead of the things that tear us apart, because they always focus on what tears us apart. always. Because they know that if we're still fighting over what we disagree on, we're never going to get to the stuff we agree on. You ask most working people, do you think we should have strong OSHA protections on the job? Most working people, the vast majority, go, yeah, I want to go home in the same conditions I went to work in. Do you think we should have health care for people when they get sick? Most people are like, yeah, we should have health care for people. Now, who does this? You know, you go back to the Nixon era, they wanted to mandate that every employer had to provide health care. And Republicans shut that down, along with some Democrats, because it wasn't enough for them. But you go down all of this stuff, all of the attacks on workers, all of the attacks on education, and it's our red state friends, the people who are wearing the red hats. Again, the guy who's the billionaire, who sadly too many working class voters have looked at and said, yeah, he's the guy. He understands me. He gets me. It's quite sad. And now you look at, you know, in talking with Sammy Sheets here a minute ago, the fact that Iowa has become the poster child, like Wisconsin was. And I spent some time thinking about, you know, the days, weeks, and months after being in Wisconsin. And I remember coming back to Pennsylvania and talking to a very prominent labor leader and saying, you know, I hope you're preparing, because everything that's happening in Wisconsin is going to make its way across the country to eventually get here. And I can't tell you how sad I am that I was right, because the successes 13 years ago in Wisconsin, even though you had 100,000 people occupying the Capitol, even though you had such activism in the state of Wisconsin, all those bad ideas have moved their way across the state. Now, here's the good thing. In Wisconsin, I do see a pushback. I see, you know, some of that stuff being repealed, but after the damage has been done, after they passed Act 10, after they took, you know, bargaining rights away from public sector workers, after they did away with their prevailing wage, after they did all the things to attack workers and the suffering that it's caused, now we're going to have to go back and clean it up. But you know who made out really well? The people who funded it, the wealthy, because that's how it always works out. And it's worked out in place after place after place. And the weird thing is, and this is the part that's bizarre to me, that Republicans with a straight face keep going back to their voters saying, we're going to pass, you know, we're going to pass the whole no rights at work agenda. We're going to pass right to work laws. We're going to do away with prevailing wage. We're going to do away with all those protections. You know, we're going to deregulate. We're going to do all of the stuff that corporate America wants. Only to find out it doesn't help. Only to find out it doesn't bring jobs. And I point to the governor of West Virginia, Jim Justice, who's running for Senate, who recently, not too recently, it's been about probably a year or so, maybe a little bit longer than that, came out and said, look, you know, we did everything that they wanted us. We passed right to work. We passed, got rid of prevailing wage. We deregulated. We did all this stuff. And the jobs didn't come, because the research is pretty conclusive. It doesn't work. You know, I know in Pennsylvania, they said, you know, if we raise the minimum wage, all the jobs are going to leave. We raised the minimum wage back, you know, 100 years ago, actually 2006. And we got a bump in jobs. We haven't raised the minimum wage in, well, since 2006, 2009 on the federal level. And we were told that, you know, by having a low minimum wage, all these jobs were going to come flooding in. That hasn't happened either. It's amazing how the right-wing spin machine, the think tank brigade, who spends so much time, energy, and money, you know, on messaging, telling us all these horror stories. You know, if you raise the minimum wage, all the jobs are going to go away, and there'll be no one having jobs, and it'll all be on welfare. And yet, when you see places that did raise the minimum wage, you see a small bump, a small positive bump in employment, because workers have more money to spend. More disposable income means more economic activity, and we used to understand this. Because workers used to get a larger share of the economic pie during the time that my red hat friends believed the country was great, you know, the 50s and 60s, when you had a prosperous working class who had the power to demand a fairer share of the profits that their wealth, that their labor created. Makes sense. You want to solve a lot of our problems? Raise wages. You know, I had someone, you know, yelling at me, you know, inflation's through the roof. I go, well, you know, if wages kept up with inflation and maybe just a little bit above, you wouldn't feel it. Problem is you don't have bargaining power at work to demand better wages in this moment. And that was, well, you know, but Joe Biden. And that seems to be the answer for everything these days. And Biden's doing everything he can do. He's encouraging people to join unions. He's encouraging unions to organize. He walked a freaking picket line, the only president in my lifetime to ever do that. Now, you know, Ronald Reagan was shot coming out of a union convention, but that wasn't a picket line. He was just leaving a convention where he was begging for money. You know, campaign cash was being asked for at the time. But, you know, we're in this moment where you have people saying we want to make the country great, and yet we're stuck in this polar world. And it comes back to us. It comes back to we, the voters, because we've bought the hats. We're on the red team or the blue team. And I can't tell you how many red team people I've talked to who have blue team ideas. But you're not allowed to talk about those ideas because we're too busy talking about all of the stuff that we don't agree with each other on. For instance, I look at the state of Washington. The state of Washington last week, the House passed legislation there that would allow workers who are either locked out by their employers or go on strike for more than a week to be able to collect unemployment benefits. That, to me, is a good thing. Why? Because it takes the power of starving the worker out. That is one of the main playbooks of the union busters. Let's see how long we can starve them. In fact, if you remember when the writers went on strike, screen actors went on strike, one of the comments coming out of the upper muckety mucks was, you know, let's see them start losing their apartments and let's see how long they'll last. They could have solved that right from the beginning. So if you take that off the table, where, you know, people are going to get a little something to be able to survive, maybe you have better relations. Maybe you have people who are going to sit down and negotiate in true good faith. Now, you go, we're going to get higher wages for workers, better health care benefits, better retirement security for workers. What does that mean? Well, that means all of the programs that we've set up, Social Security, Medicare, all of our social safety net programs, people with higher wages pay higher taxes. That means more revenue coming in. The reason a lot of our things have struggled, stagnant wages, declining wages. So we got the handfuls who are hoarding, and there's no trickle down to the working class. At what point do you go, when do we get attention? When do policies that benefit working families get attention? And the truth of the matter is it's never going to happen unless working people take off their red hats and their blue hats and talk about the issues that really matter. I keep saying put on the green hat, because the green hat is the one that's the most important. That's the one the corporate folk, that's what they care about. It's all about the money. And I got to tell you, the hope is that we wake up sooner as opposed to later and push back. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. I got a lot more to get to right back after this. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. This day in labor history, the year was 1937. That was the day the National Lawyers Guild held their first convention in the nation's capital. The guild was established as a way to bring together progressive lawyers dedicated to fighting for basic and progressive change in our political and economic system, and to assure that human rights be regarded as more sacred than property interests. Members were admitted regardless of race, sex, or political beliefs. The early guild Guild stood up for FDR's New Deal reforms like a full Social Security program against the staunch opposition of the American Bar Association. From its inception, protecting the rights of working people has been an important effort for the Guild. At the first convention, they passed a resolution supporting the rights of working people to organize and collectively bargain. Guild lawyers supported the founding of both the United Auto Workers and the Congress of Industrial Organizations. They also stood up for civil rights, adopting an anti-lynching resolution at their first convention. During the civil rights era, they provided legal aid for activists and fought for voting rights. This made them a target during the 1950s Cold War anti-communist hysteria. The FBI targeted the Guild for investigation. By 1955, the Guild had dropped to just 500 members. In the 1970s, the Guild successfully sued to find out the extent of FBI spying. They discovered that 1,000 informants had generated FBI files of 400,000 pages on the Guild and its members. Despite this harassment, the Guild has kept up its fight for working people. The organization has opposed anti-worker legislation from Taft-Hartley to the passage of NAFTA. In 2012, the Guild celebrated its 75th anniversary stronger than ever.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So I point to New Hampshire. New Hampshire has been trying to pass a right-to-work law for, I think, since 2011, since Wisconsin went ahead and did it. And you look at this, the reality is the states that have gone and done the whole corporate no rights at work agenda, going after right-to-work laws, going after prevailing wage laws, the jobs haven't materialized. It didn't work. What it did do, and it did masterfully, and this is borne out in numbers, it led to lower wages, it led to less health care, it led to less pension retirement security. As you know, everyone at the time was saying that it was going to do, because we know the states that don't have bargaining rights or full bargaining rights, they have lower wages, less health care, less retirement. That's reality. Now, the argument is, well, you know, Rick, they've got a lower standard of living down in those states. You know, it takes less money to earn a living. Nonsense. The people who do this research, they adjust for all of that. And the reality is wages are lower. And that gap has closed over the last couple of decades. It used to be, when I first started, it was like 20%. It's now down to about 4 or 5% because union density has fallen, and the ability for workers to demand more in a wide swaths of industries gone. And you can get that back. My grandparents' generation, they understood it. You can get it back, but you got to fight for it. And it comes down to the politics. And as long as we're fighting over the who can marry who or what bathroom someone can go to or other nonsense that, honestly doesn't mean anything to most of us. The stuff that really matters, the stuff that really could unite us, never gets addressed. Never. I mean, the fact that New Hampshire is, again, still trying to push this through, knowing that everyone who's done it before them has failed, that tells you it's not about what they're telling you it's about. It's about pure ideology. It's about power and control. And this is what working people need to grasp. Look, I may not agree with what you do within the confines of your four walls, what you believe or what you think, but ultimately what can bind us together is ensuring that we make a decent living, that our kids don't go hungry, that we have policies that actually make lives better. What's, again, still mind-boggling to me is when the right got their wish, when the wet dream came true and they were able to make Roe go away, there was a part of me that really thought there was going to be one of those good God-fearing Christian Republicans to come forth and go, you know what? Now that we're gonna make them women have them babies, we're gonna help them take care of it. We're gonna do the Christian thing. you know, I saw this clip on one of the social media sites, you know, former drug addict, former, basically dreg of society, entertainer, saying that, you know, I think the Christians have it wrong. Jesus wouldn't be hanging out with middle-class families in yuppie neighborhoods or, the good people. He hung out with the prostitutes and the thieves and the people who needed help. Maybe we think that again. And I go, but there's no money in that. Sadly, we've become this very, we're a capitalist country. Congratulations. Capitalism won. And while that's happening, what we have is a breakdown of civility, of humanity, of empathy, of compassion, of all the things that make us human, of all the things that can make us decent people. And the fact that Donald Trump is the face of the Republican Party. He is the Republican Party. And look, you know, I've said it before. He didn't do this. He was just at the right place at the right time and took advantage of where the party was already going and where the masses were heading. He is the talk radio baby. He is the illegitimate child of talk radio and cable news. The question is when do we turn the channel? When do we demand better? When do we say enough is enough? When do we say, look, I've been saying this for a long time. I don't hate my red hat friends. I question their sanity. I do that quite often. I question, what they think they're going to get. For instance, a number of them are, going, if they can go after Donald Trump and they can fine him $355 million, they can do that to you too. And they go, yeah, they've always been able to do that to us. They've always been able to go after working people. Look at the number of audits that have happened to people who they believe cheated on the earned income tax credit. People making less than 25 grand a year. Often do they go after them. The surprising part is they went after someone like Trump. And not only did they go after him, they convicted him. They got him because he's wrong. He did what they said he did. And I just find it interesting that people are defending that as if by holding him accountable, somehow it's going to mean us. It's crazy. But I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, want to hear it, miss any portion of the program, make sure you grab the podcast. Thanks so much for being here. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. Email Rick at rick@thericksmithshow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay. WGBW 1590 AM Denmark. W250 CB Green Bay. And always streaming on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Daria Albinger. The University of Alabama Birmingham Hospital, one of the state's largest, is stopping IVF treatment after the state Supreme Court ruled that embryos were children.
During IVF, multiple embryos are typically frozen to improve families' chances of a successful pregnancy. Now, it could be a crime to destroy them. Candidate Nikki Haley agreeing with the state court. Haley did not say what this could mean for Alabama families who are relying on IVF to conceive.
ABC's Elizabeth Schulze. President Biden's forgiving student loan debt for more than 150,000 Americans. A New Hampshire jury is deliberating the fate of Adam Montgomery. He's accused of murdering his 5-year-old daughter in a fit of rage. At least 14 people are dead, more injured after an illegally operated open-pit gold mine collapsed in Venezuela. Call it Panda Diplomacy 2.0. China sending more of the animals to the San Diego Zoo this year. This is ABC News. According to the most recent minutes, Federal Reserve officials admit there's been significant progress on cutting inflation. But at their January meeting, policymakers expressed concern about moving too fast in cutting interest rates. There's been a lot of talk lately in Hollywood about gender equity, but apparently there's still a lot of work to do.
Hi, Barbie.
Yes, 2023 was a big year for Barbie, but that film was an anomaly when it comes to women in starring roles. Just 30% of the top 100 films of last year featured a female star or co-lead, according to a new report by USC's Annenberg Inclusion Initiative. That's the lowest percentage in a decade and well off the record high of 44% the year before. The initiative's founder, Stacey L. Smith, called the numbers a, quote, catastrophic step back for girls and women in film. A similar study from January found even worse representation behind the camera. Just 12% of directors were women. Jason Athens in ABC News, Hollywood.
Charlie Woods, son of Tiger Woods, is taking the first step to play